Chapter 10. Sally Pengelly was waiting for Matthew in the mortuary, gowned and booted. Thanks for doing this so speedily at a weekend. Matthew knew she had a family, a husband who was a head teacher of a village primary school and at least three children. He and Jonathan had been invited once to a barbecue at their home, a rambling place with a garden and orchard, a paddock with ponies. There had been a lot of children there, all running wild, and he hadn't quite worked out which of them belonged to Sally. It had been a chaotic and good-humoured evening. Jonathan had loved it. Matthew, not quite so much. There had been insects, and they'd had to sit on the grass. "This suits me better than tomorrow morning," she said. "Finn's got running club and Joe's at youth orchestra. Freddie says the surf's looking good, so he has to be at Croyd. Bloody kids rule our lives." A pause. "And we didn't want to leave Dr. Yeo at the Locust longer than necessary. That poor young woman, with her father's dead body on her doorstep, in her workplace." Matthew nodded. "You don't need to stay throughout." Sally was already focused on the body on the stainless steel table. The mortuary technician moved quietly and efficiently beside her. "Cause of death is pretty clear, and of course we have an ID." She looked back at Matthew. "We've had quite a day. You'll be glad to be home. So let's get on with it, shall we?" Her assistant started cutting away Nigel's clothes, and Sally provided the running commentary. "In the trouser pockets we have a handkerchief and two sets of house keys. No car keys." She turned again to Matthew, a question. "They'd been left in his car," Matthew said. He wondered if that was significant. Had Yeo been distracted when he arrived? Did he trust the Westercombe residents not to steal the vehicle? But wasn't locking a car automatic? Matthew kept a running log throughout an investigation, and now he opened the blue hardback notebook and wrote a reminder to check with Eve if her father usually left his vehicle unlocked when he was at the farm. Sally was still speaking. "The cause of death is a stab wound to the neck and severing of the artery and critical nerves controlling cardiac and brain function. Bleeding will have been brisk, at least until the blood pressure dropped, and we noted the pulsatile nature of the spatter on the workshop wall." Matthew closed his eyes for a moment and pictured the crime scene, the blood. It was hard to imagine that one man could produce so much. Sally continued. "The murder weapon was this piece of glass. The axial strength meant that it didn't shatter, though there is evidence of deformation where it hit the bone." She turned to Matthew. "Really, this is all as we thought at the Locus." "I did wonder," he said, "if the glass was window dressing, there for effect." She shook her head. "Glass can be remarkably strong. I did part of my training in Aberdeen, plenty of glassings in pub brawls there." She paused for a moment. "Go home to your husband. I'll get my report to you as soon as I can, and I'll be in touch immediately if I come across anything unusual." For a moment he hesitated. Duty had become a habit, almost reassuring, an excuse to avoid the personal. But Sally was right. There was nothing more for him to do here. It was dark when he got home, but Jonathan was still in the kitchen playing music, something cool and bluesy that Matthew didn't recognize. Jonathan was at the sink, peeling vegetables. He turned and took Matthew briefly into his arms. No words until they'd separated. "I met Eve today. She told me what had happened." "Will she hold it together, do you think?" Matthew took a seat at the long table. "Yeah, in the end. To lose her father so soon after her mother." Jonathan paused. "I invited her to come and stay. I don't think she should be on her own there, so close to where her father was killed." Matthew looked up sharply. For a moment he couldn't quite believe what Jonathan had said. "She's a witness to a murder. A potential suspect. You can't see that it would be impossible to have her here." "You really believe that Eve could have killed her father?" Jonathan's face was set, stubborn. "And that protocol is more important than kindness?" "The rules matter." Matthew was aware of his voice rising, that he was almost shouting, and made an effort to remain calm, reasonable. "Sometimes they're the only thing between us and chaos." They stood staring at each other in silence. Matthew broke it first. He nodded towards the sink. "I'm sorry, but I'm really not that hungry." "This isn't for tonight," Jonathan said. I'm getting prepped for tomorrow, your mother's grand lunch. His voice was brighter. In his mind, at least, the tension between them was over. He was clearly looking forward to the occasion. He put his arm around Matthew and kissed him lightly. That was Jonathan all over. He hated confrontation and never saw the point of letting an argument drag on. He thought that a moment of tenderness could make everything better. Matthew felt the old dread settle like a headache, but said nothing. Chapter 11. Ross and Mel had a routine for Sundays if neither of them was working. Sometimes she had to go in. She was manager of an old folks' home and took her job seriously. It wasn't fair, she said, for the care staff to work shifts if she didn't take her turn. She'd started working there when she was 16, fitting it in around taking the care qualification at the FE college on the edge of the town. They'd already been going out then, childhood sweethearts. She'd worked her way up from care assistant, from wearing the ugly pink tabards to her own clothes. Always smart. Ross hadn't liked to think of her wiping the old men's bums, had been a bit embarrassed about her job, but he was proud of her now. Mel and Ross had met at school. She had always been the prettiest in the class, and not just good-looking, but easy-going and even-tempered, too. Not one of the stuck-up girls who thought it was clever to badmouth or tease. Not pushy or overly academic. Despite her looks, he had never found her intimidating. They'd first started going out when they were 15 and had been married in their early 20s. Ross's parents had been through hard times, and he didn't want that for himself. He'd already mapped out his life before Mel walked down the aisle to be his wife. Security was important. He and Mel had bought their own home while their friends were still renting or spending their cash on travel and flash cars instead of investing in their future. Ross had grand plans for his future. Promotion, a bigger house. That would be the time for fancy holidays. Sunday morning started with the club run. Ross liked his sport. In the winter it was rugby. Joe Oldham had introduced him to the club when Ross was still a boy, and the superintendent came along to cheer at most of the important matches, though he usually retired to the bar at half-time. This time of year, Ross still wanted to keep fit. He had a horror of ending up like his dad, flabby, his belly hanging over his belt, taking no pride in his appearance. Mel was a good runner too, and went out with her mates some mornings, coming back glowing, laughing just with the pleasure of the exercise. Ross thought that was when he loved her most. She was a credit to him. He'd tried to persuade Jen Rafferty along to the run, but she'd looked at him as if he was crazy. Are you joking? On a Sunday morning? Ross wished Jen would take him more seriously. Everything was a joke to her, because he only had her best interests at heart. At her age, she could use more exercise, and it wouldn't hurt if she cut down on the booze. Not that he said anything about that. Jen had a way with words that made you wary, that could cut into you like a knife. With one sentence, she could slice away his confidence and his self-belief. If he'd known her at school, she'd have been one of the girls he'd have avoided like the plague. After the run, Mel always did a cooked breakfast. It was the high point of his week. Some of their running mates went out for brunch in a cafe close to the park, but Ross could never see the point. It all cost money, and anyway, the food wasn't great. There was nowhere decent to eat in Barnstable, and Mel was a great cook. Today it was scrambled eggs and smoked salmon on sourdough toast. Afterwards, she made a pot of real coffee. On weekdays, they made do with instant, and they took their mugs out into the garden. He sat with his face to the sun and thought this was all he'd ever wanted, to be a good cop and a good husband, maybe a good father when the time was right. Mel got up from her deck chair and began to pull a few weeds from the flower bed next to the path. He looked at his watch. I've got to go into the station. We're working on that murder out at Westercombe, and the boss has decided he's got something important on at home. Who knows what Jen will be up to? He rolled his eyes. One of us has got to be there. She was still crouched and turned to face him, her eyes screwed up against the sun. No worries, she said. I'll do the washing up, shall I? He thought he caught an edge to her voice, a touch of sarcasm. Is that okay? He wouldn't want to upset her for the world. Yeah. She stood up and smiled. I know how important your work is. There was a moment of relief. He should have known she wouldn't have a go at him. He was overreacting, I won't be back until late-ish. I've got to take a witness statement out at Insto. Then there'll be the briefing. That's all right. I might go out for a drink with the girls. Again, he thought he caught an undercurrent of resentment. But when he looked at her face, she was still smiling. The police station was like a sauna. The sun was streaming through the windows that had never been opened, and, of course, there was no aircon. Ross looked again at the list of the calls Nigel Yeo had made in the previous week. Besides those to Eve and to Lauren Miller, everything seemed work-related. He must have been a sad bastard. Not much social life at all. There was a text sent at 6 o'clock on the evening before his death by Cynthia Pryor. Looking forward to seeing you later. Nothing else that day. So, Ross thought, any meeting at Westercombe had been arranged previously. Or Nigel had been contacted on his landline. Or he'd turned up on the spur of the moment. That was speculation, of course. Ross had learned from Joe Oldham to be suspicious of speculation. But Matthew Venn thought it was a useful tool. Our job is all about what if. No harm creating a number of scenarios and seeing if the facts fit. The danger comes when you twist the facts to fit the theory. It was still a bit early to be heading out to Insto, but Ross left the station anyway. He thought he'd call in at the house, surprise Mel. They might go to bed. Sex in the afternoon had always been his favourite, and somehow they'd got out of the way of it. Too busy, both of them. He was excited, a schoolboy again, planning illicit jaunts with his girlfriend, as he drove through the new executive estate, past the men washing cars and the kids playing out. But when he got there, Mel's car wasn't in the drive. Perhaps she'd popped round to her parents. He rang her, but when she didn't reply, he decided not to wait. The moment of uncharacteristic spontaneity had passed. There were more cars heading away from Insto as he drove there than were making their way to the coast. Family Sunday afternoons were a time of preparation for the week ahead. Homework, hair wash, the ironing of school uniform. At least, that was how it had been when he was a boy. And this wasn't yet prime grockle season. A few people were still in the sandpiper, but they were lingering over coffee, relaxed. Ross had never been in there. It wasn't his sort of place. Most of the customers were his parents' age. A young woman was drying glasses at the counter. Blonde hair, a white blouse, the cotton thin enough that he could see her bra. She moved out to clear a table and he saw she was wearing skinny jeans and Converse sand shoes. Janie McKenzie? Yes? She seemed to see him for the first time. Oh, you must be the detective. Dad said someone would be coming. Yes, I need to talk to you about Friday night. She was still carrying a tray. Just a minute, I need to get rid of this. She disappeared into the kitchen and returned soon after with a middle-aged man. This is my dad. He'll cover while I talk to you. Do you mind if we walk on the beach? I've been stuck in all day. She looked at him, waiting for his agreement. Of course, if that's what you'd prefer. She gave him a smile and he followed her out of the door. Outside it was early afternoon. Even hotter, and despite the cars heading back to Barnstable, the beach was still heaving. Kids were running in and out of the water, splashing and screaming. Janie took off her shoes and made her way to the sea's edge, then walked away from the worst of the crowd towards the far end of the beach. He wasn't sure what to do. He was dressed for work, not for the shore. In the end, he followed her, but stayed on the dry sand, just about close enough to speak to her without shouting. Friday night, you were at a party with Wesley Curnow. Yeah, not exactly my idea of fun. She pulled a face that made him smile. Why did you go then? Ross wasn't sure where the question had come from. How could this be relevant to the investigation? But something about her intrigued him. He'd expected her to be confident, arrogant even. She'd been to a fancy university, was good-looking in a way that would catch attention wherever she went, and she had a mother who was a minor celebrity. Ross was always suspicious of people who were better educated than him. He sensed they were judging him. Janie didn't give that impression, though. There was something of the little girl about her, nervy but precocious. He thought she'd say the first thing that came into her head, no filter, no matter how that might seem to the listener. She shrugged. She was wearing big sunglasses now and he couldn't really see her face, couldn't tell what she was thinking. I was bored. I thought anything would be better than staying in or working. And Wes is a mate. He asked. He didn't quite tell me what I was letting myself in for. Did you see Nigel Yeo there? She turned her back to the sun. It was white and bright, and she was almost a silhouette. Yes, he didn't stay very late. Long enough for you to speak to him? We had a quick chat. He and I were probably the only sober people at the party. She gave a little laugh. Middle-aged drinkers, what are they like? I know. They walked on for a moment in almost companionable silence. How well did you know him, Dr. Yeo? Ross was trying to put himself into Matthew Venn's shoes, to ask the questions the boss might ask. He hadn't wanted to like Venn when he'd first arrived, but the way the new detective had dealt with the body at Crow Point and all the drama of the aftermath had earned a grudging admiration. Not well at all, Janie said. He was a friend of my parents, at least a kind of friend. He was trying to find out what happened to my brother, why he was allowed out of hospital to commit suicide. What do you think happened to your brother? Another Venn-like question. It seemed to surprise her, and she paused for a moment. I think he was ill, and he killed himself. He had pretty shit treatment from the NHS, but I don't think anyone could have stopped him if he'd wanted to do it. He was really quite stubborn. I think my parents feel guilty because they couldn't love him. Not really. He was so fucked up and so different from them. So they're looking for someone else to blame. Could you love him? For a moment, Ross was afraid she'd laugh at him. If anyone had asked him a question like that, he'd have been embarrassed and covered it up with laughter. But Janie considered it seriously. Yes, she said. I loved him. He was demanding and self-obsessed, and there was no protective wall between him and the universe, so he made everyone around him believe they had a duty to look after him. But he could be joyous and gentle, and he looked after me too. He was my little brother. She seemed lost in thought. We came on holidays to North Devon, before we moved down for good and took over the business. Mum spent her first big repeat fees from TV on a little chalet in the dunes at Seal Bay. It was magical, like something out of a kid's book. Mac and I ran wild, rock pooling and surfing, picnics and ice cream, long walks on Seal Point. Mum was never really a hands-on parent, and most of the time she was learning lines for the next ep. Dad wasn't there much. He still had his permanent job in IT, so mostly it was just the two of us. Mac was a weird little scrap even then, but I don't remember any arguments or sibling rivalry. Nothing like that. Seal Point was where he killed himself. Yeah, I guess it was his happy place. She looked at Ross. Somewhere he felt at peace. They walked on. Ross could feel sand in his shoes, gritty between his socks and his skin, but it didn't seem the time to take them off. What would that look like when Janie was so at home on the beach? On Friday night, you gave Wesley a lift home, but not all the way? I dropped him at the end of the lane leading towards the farm. He was pissed, and I thought the walk would do him good. Besides, he didn't have anything to wake up for, and I knew I'd be working on breakfasts. This is your full-time job, working in the cafe? For the moment, she walked out of the shallow water and joined him. I've got a degree, from Oxford, but there's not much call for students of Victorian fiction in contemporary Britain. Ross didn't know what to say to that. Wesley says a car passed him going very fast, coming down the lane from Westercombe, but he was quite vague about it. As you say, he was drunk, so he wasn't terribly convincing. No details. Something about that might come back to him, but it's not very helpful at the moment. You didn't see a speeding car going up towards the farm when you dropped him off. Not then, but later there was some maniac driving through the village much too fast. Can you describe the car? Black. One of those MTBs. MTB? She smiled. Much too big for the lanes and the roads round here. He smiled too, though he wouldn't mind something solid when he could afford it. A Range Rover, something of that kind. Did you catch the registration number? No way, it just flashed past. Is there anything else you can tell me about Dr. Yeo? Any reason why someone might want him dead? She didn't answer immediately, and he thought Janie might have something, some little bit of information to make sense of the killing. But as they walked back to the road, she shook her head again. No, she said. Nigel was a lovely man. Everyone will tell you that. Chapter 12. On Sunday mornings, if she wasn't working, Jen usually stayed in bed until lunchtime. In the past, she'd tried to do the good mum thing and attempted a roast. Meat, veg, Yorkshire puddings, the whole deal. But it hadn't seemed worth it since Ella had decided she was mostly veggie, and Ben made it clear he'd rather be talking to his friends online, playing some computer game. All that effort, she'd thought, for a meal nobody really wanted to eat. She'd given up, and now Sunday was her day for a lie-in. Today, though, she was up before the kids and on the phone to her friend Cynthia, who was always awake early. In a way, it seemed to Jen that Cynthia's party had been at the start of the whole investigation. "You'll have heard about your mate Nigel. Could I come around for a chat? It's official." Though, as Matthew says, gossip has its place too. "Of course." Jen heard Cynthia take a breath and knew she was about to fire off a load of questions, so she cut off the conversation quickly. She didn't want to get into details on the phone. "Get the coffee on then. I'll be there in 20 minutes. Cynthia's husband opened the door. Sometimes Roger Pryor joined them when Jen went to visit, but more often he hid himself away in his office. He was a tall, dignified man, unremarkable except for a head of very dark, almost black hair, which Jen was convinced must be dyed. It seemed a strange vanity for someone so reserved. Only now did it occur to Jen that, when it came to the investigation, Pryor might be an even more useful contact than Cynthia. He worked as something vague but important for the local NHS Trust, and, of course, she should have made the connection before. "Cynthia's waiting for you in the garden," he said. They were standing in an entrance hall bigger than Jen's living room. All pale wood and family photos. "We're both rather shaken. The man who died in Westercombe was a neighbour of ours. I'm on the team investigating his murder." "Oh," he said. "I suppose you can't discuss it then. I understand all about confidentiality." "Nigel must have been your colleague at one time, and he was still looking into a case which involves the trust. You might be able to help." "I don't think I can," the man said. "You'll need to contact the hospital about that." He gave a tight, sad smile. "I'm governed by confidentiality too, I'm afraid." There was a moment of silence. "Why don't you go on through? Cynthia's waiting for you." He disappeared through a door. Jen had a brief glimpse of an office, a desk, a wall of bookshelves, then the door was firmly closed. She'd been to the house many times, but she'd never been inside that room. In the garden, Cynthia was sitting on a white wooden chair, her head tilted back, her eyes closed against the sun. She was wearing a long silk tunic in blues and purples over white linen trousers, silver sandals and silver toenails. This week, her hair was purple too. Jen had never thought of herself as a jealous woman, but she envied Cynthia her garden. Could have come out of one of those magazines she read occasionally in the dentist's waiting room. Everywhere there was colour, and the lawn was as smooth as a carpet without moss or weed. The beds a mix of exotic flowers and vivid, shiny-leaved shrubs. Of course, the Pryors could afford a gardener, and Cynthia merely supervised. A jug of coffee and two mugs stood on a white wrought-iron table. Cynthia heard Jen approaching and turned to face her. She looked as if she'd hardly slept. The purple circles under her eyes were real, not cosmetic to match the hair.
"I can't believe it," she said. "Wesley phoned me yesterday evening. He thought we should know."
There was an implied criticism. "Why didn't you tell me?"
"I'm part of the team investigating his murder," Jen repeated the words. "We were pretty tied up."
Sometimes Cynthia forgot that other people had kids and full-time jobs.
"Oh, I can understand, but it was just such a shock."
"He was here on Friday night." Jen poured coffee. "The party didn't really seem his kind of thing."
"It wasn't. He was only here to see you."
"What do you mean? I've never met him before."
"He called in on Friday afternoon. He knew we were friends."
Cynthia looked up, and for a moment she was herself again. "It's quite something having a mate who's a detective sergeant. A bit of a talking point, kind of vicarious celebrity. He asked if I'd be able to set up a meeting.
Rather urgent, he said. I told him you'd be coming to the party and he'd be welcome. I wasn't sure if he'd come along, but there he was. A pause. I thought the two of you might get on. He lost his wife to early onset Alzheimer's, so he was on his own too. Jen ignored Cynthia's implied matchmaking. After the man's death, the idea seemed hugely inappropriate. Grotesque, as if Cynthia was suggesting she should hook up with a corpse. What time did he arrive here on Friday? It might not be important, but Ven would want to know. I'm not sure. 5-ish, maybe a bit later? Cynthia paused. He seemed a little out of sorts. Did he say why he wanted to talk to me? Cynthia shook her head. No, it was all very mysterious, very secret squirrel. How well did you know him? Well enough to have had him round for dinner a few times. His wife, Helen, was my real friend. I got closer to Nigel when he cut back his hours to care for her. When he started at Patience Together, he could work a lot from home. I went sometimes to sit with her to give him a break, and so he could work with Eve on the glass. He was taking some kind of course. He and Roger must have been colleagues, though, when he was still working at the hospital. That must have been another point of connection. Oh. Now Cynthia seemed deliberately vague. I don't think so. Roger's just an admin person, really. Nigel was on the front line. Until he took up his new investigative role with Patients Together. He must have come into contact with Roger then. Nigel had taken up the case of the Mackenzie boy, hadn't he? He had some idea that negligence by the trust had led to his suicide. A pause. That must have been difficult for Roger. There was a moment of silence. Jen had always thought that she and Cynthia were close friends. Very different in lifestyle, of course. And Synth, with her monthly trip to the hairdresser and her exuberant, expensive clothes, didn't seem to have a clue about the real world until she sat in the magistrate's court. Then she seemed to have an unusual understanding of the offenders who stood before her. Occasionally, Jen wondered if Cynthia's family had been dysfunctional too. Perhaps the woman's empathy came from her own experience. Honestly, Jen, I can't talk about Nigel's role in the Mackenzie case. I think there's an ongoing investigation within the hospital, and you'll have to ask Roger about that. Now the woman sounded uncomfortable. I just did. He ran away into his office without answering. Another silence. In the distance, a neighbour was mowing a lawn. There was the scent of roses and cut grass. It was all very perfect. At this moment, Jen didn't quite believe in perfection. She hoped she hadn't offended Cynthia, but she had warned her friend in advance that this conversation would be official. Jen thought her work would always come before personal considerations. Her husband had never quite realised that. It had been one of the many matters of contention. It was his view, often stated, that she should be a wife first. For a woman, work should come way down the list. Actually, Cynthia said at last, Nigel was becoming a bit of a thorn in the authorities' side, a bit overreaching. The brief of Patients Together was traditionally quite narrow, but he extended it. In what way? In the past, it represented patients in a more general sense. They advised on policy, provided feedback on services. Nigel seemed willing to become involved in more personal disputes between patients and the health authority. Roger thought it was a little unprofessional. He felt it almost as a betrayal. He said that Nigel was acting like a sort of private detective, not a former employee of the NHS. And it was the Alexander Mackenzie suicide that was causing the particular problem? Cynthia, usually so composed and confident, seemed to squirm a little in her seat. Nigel had taken an interest in other cases previously, but he appeared to have got a bee in his bonnet about the way George Mackenzie's son had been treated before he committed suicide. She looked directly at Jen. You can see how awkward that was, for me as well as for Roger. George is a friend. I've been going to the Sandpiper since he started doing music there. I sympathised. But Roger's my husband, and he needed my support through it all, too. The last thing he wanted was a press witch hunt about the trust's mental health provision. Nigel wasn't a psychiatrist, and he should never have involved himself in something so close to home. There was a definite conflict of interest. Is that why Nigel wanted to see me on Friday night, to discuss Alexander Mackenzie's death? I don't know, Cynthia gave a quick glance back to the house. To make sure her husband isn't listening in? To be honest, I didn't want to know. I didn't speak to Nigel for very long. Jen had never seen Cynthia quite so jumpy, not even when a guy out of his head on spice had threatened her with a knife when she was coming out of court. Did you talk to him before he left? He came to say goodbye, Cynthia said. Of course he did. He was a gent. He wouldn't have just wandered off. She was speaking very quickly, like a kid rattling off an excuse to a teacher. Too much coffee? She'd already topped up her mug and she liked it black and very strong. Or was she hurrying to move the conversation on in a different direction? Did Nigel say where he was going when he left here? We found his car at Westercombe, so we presumed that he drove himself there, either that night or early the next morning. Jen tried to keep her voice even, but she was losing patience, and she was hurt because she'd thought they were friends, proper friends, and here was Synth treating her like some sort of moron who could be lied to. There was no answer. Cynthia, someone stuck a shard of glass half a metre long into his neck. We're not fucking about here. This isn't a couple of lasses shoplifting from Marx's. He said he was meeting someone. Polite as always. Brilliant party, Cynthia, but I've got to go, I'm afraid. It seemed a bit weird. I mean, why would you arrange a meeting so late? Perhaps, Jen thought. He'd realised I was in no fit state for an intelligent conversation, and he just made an excuse to leave. So, she said, he was expecting someone at his house. That's what I thought he meant. He might have had guests coming to stay. He's close to Helen's parents. I suppose he could have been waiting for a phone call. Cynthia looked up, part defiant, part pleading for Jen to believe her. You know what it was like here on Friday night? Music, background noise. I can't really be sure what he meant. He didn't mention going to see his daughter, a trip out to Westercombe. I don't think so. Honestly, Jen, you spoke to him as long as I did that night. There were lots of other guests, and I wanted to make sure everyone had a good time. The lawnmower in the neighbour's equally perfect garden chugged on. A blackbird sang. But Jen thought Cynthia wasn't being straight. She was keeping a secret. Or secrets, and things would never be the same between them again. Jen pushed herself out of the chair and stood up. Cynthia stayed where she was, eyes closed. Where was Roger on Friday night? The question came out more loudly than Jen had expected. The eyes opened. He stayed out for the evening, keeping out of the way. You know he has to be in the mood for a party. But where was he? Cynthia stood up too, slowly and carefully, making a point, and they stood staring at each other. What's this about, Jen? Do you think he needs an alibi? Should I be phoning for our lawyer? Her accent was even more upper class than usual. Don't mess with me, pleb. I only asked, Synth. Now Jen just felt tired. She wished she could have had her usual lion and a proper breakfast. I just need to know where everyone who had any dealings with Nigel Yeo was that night. It's my work, like it's Roger's work, to protect the health authority. He stayed in the office at the hospital, Cynthia said, each word spoken a bit too clearly, a bit too slowly. He was working late. It's a stressful job keeping the show on the road with too little money, too few nurses, too few doctors. He often works late. What time did he get home? Cynthia shrugged. I haven't got a clue. I was out in the garden with half a dozen guests who stayed on until about 12. Wes was playing music. Janie joined in singing until she got bored. It was all very chilled, all very ordinary. When I went to bed, Roger was already there, fast asleep. She turned to face Jen and her words became hard, sarcastic. I suppose he would just have had time to drive to Westercombe and stick that piece of glass in Nigel's neck if Nigel headed for the farm as soon as he left here. But I'd have thought there would have been blood. Roger's work suit was hanging in the wardrobe and his shirt was in the linen basket. I put it in the washing machine this morning. There were no stains. I can promise you that. She gave a harsh little laugh. You do see how ridiculous this is. Jen didn't answer. She thought there was nothing faintly funny about the violent death of a good man. Normally, they would have hugged before they left each other and made some arrangement to meet up soon. Today, Cynthia marched ahead of Jen around the side of the house to the front gate, assuming that the detective would follow. It seemed Jen wasn't even to be allowed to take the shortcut through the house, through the kitchen with the shiny granite worktops, and the hall with the pale wood panels, past the firmly closed door where Roger was working. Or hiding. She was being treated like a tradesman, the gardener or the window cleaner. At the fancy wrought iron gate, they paused for a moment, awkward, both of them prickly, two strong women facing off. Ridiculous, Jen thought. She opened her arms. It's just my work, she said. It gets in the way of friendship. Cynthia hesitated, and Jen thought she would come in for that hug, but in the end she didn't move any closer. Let's hope this gets quickly sorted, then maybe we can be friends again. The magistrate turned and walked away, the long silk tunic floating behind her, leaving Jen standing, her arms still outstretched, waiting for the embrace. Chapter 13. On Sunday morning, Matthew Venn woke early, as he always did. There remained the sense of unease that had nothing to do with the investigation. He'd always found work easier, certainly less complicated, than the personal baggage which weighed him down. This was his mother's birthday, and she would soon be sitting at their long kitchen table eating Sunday lunch. He still couldn't quite believe her change of heart, and wasn't sure if he'd be hurt or relieved if she called the meeting off at the last minute, making some excuse about a sick sister or brother. Not talking about a relative, but a member of the Brethren, the community into which he'd been born. By the time he'd showered and dressed, Jonathan was up too. There was music playing and Jonathan was singing along loud and tunefully and starting to pull out the ingredients he needed for the grand birthday cake. A rib of beef had already been taken from the fridge and would cook slowly, Matthew was told, until it melted in the mouth. Jonathan loved entertaining. Everything about it, the preparation and the cooking and the sitting down with friends. Matthew still couldn't quite enjoy it, but he was starting to get there. Not with his mother, though. Not with the crabby, anxious woman whose life was fixed with certainty and who despised everything that her son had become. They had coffee and toast together, with the music still playing. Outside, the sun was shining, but they took that for granted. They'd all come to expect it now. The clear skies and the heat wave. We could have lunch in the garden, Jonathan said. I could set the table out there. Oh, God, no. She'd hate it. As she'd hate anything adventurous and different. Okay, in here then, but I'll bring in flowers, loads of flowers. Jonathan set down his coffee cup. And give me a ring just as you're about to pick her up. I'll have everything ready. A pause. You will be on time, won't you? This is more important than work, for today at least. Matthew nodded. Now all this was started, he had to see it through to the end. It was a relief to be on the road and heading to Barnstable. The traffic wasn't too heavy yet, and without needing the sat-nav, he found the house where Helen Yeo had died, and where Nigel Yeo had mourned her. It was a pleasantly proportioned house, substantial, not grand. It backed onto the road out of the town, but was close to the shops and pubs of Newport, not far from Jen's little terrace, a part of the community, not separate from it. There was a high wall to keep the traffic noise from the garden, and Matthew struggled at first to find a way in. The entrance was from a side street and led into a shadowy garden, an oasis away from the town, with the muffled rumble of cars and lorries in the distance. Eve had given him a key. The crime scene team had been through the house but hadn't yet done a detailed search. It found no indication of violence there. It was clear that Yeo had been murdered where he was found. Inside it was cool. Matthew moved through the house to get a sense of the place before looking at it in any detail. This was a family home, but no longer lived in by a family. It was tidier than it would have been when Eve was a child. They already knew that Nigel had employed a cleaner. A woman who'd worked there for years, coming in on Thursday mornings for 3 hours to clean the bathrooms and the kitchen. But there was none of the clutter that had probably been there when Nigel's wife was alive and when Eve was still at home. One mug, rinsed and ready to go in the dishwasher, on the draining board in the kitchen. A pair of slippers carefully placed together close to the entrance hall. a copy of Friday's Guardian, neatly folded on a coffee table in the living room, which looked out over the garden. There was a small television, the controls tidily arranged on the shelf beside it. It seemed that when the illness had taken over Helen's mind and her body, Yo had moved her downstairs to a pleasant little living room with a view of trees. The bed was still there, with its mattress cover and three pillows piled at one end. The nightstand had a cassette recorder on a shelf and a pile of audiobooks and music. Perhaps he couldn't quite bring himself to clear the place. Matthew wondered how he'd cope if Jonathan was suddenly ill, if he'd have Nigel Yeo's dedication and patience to look after his husband this well. He hoped that he would. Then he thought ill health would probably hit his mother first. When he asked himself the same question about caring for her, he had no reply. He moved upstairs and into Yeo's study, which had been converted from the smallest bedroom. It faced the road and a row of smaller houses opposite. Matthew saw a gaggle of people going into the Baptist church on the other side of the road. He started opening drawers in the desk, not quite sure what he was looking for, and came across a large diary with a page for every day. The diary contained both work and personal appointments. The writing was tidy, a little cramped. It seemed to Matthew that this was a man in control of his life. He checked the entries for the week before Yo's death. There were a number of appointments marked. One said, "Team Meeting." Beside it, he'd drawn a face with a downturned mouth. It seemed he hadn't been looking forward to that one. Others all seemed to be work-related. Sessions with community groups and one with a social worker. A visit to a care home in a rural village. On the Friday of Cynthia's party, it seemed he'd had two meetings in the hospital. The first seemed more significant. Three names were listed, but one jumped out. Roger Pryor. Matthew knew Cynthia Pryor through court, and this must be the husband who worked for the Health Trust. Another connection. Further down the page, there was another entry. Party, Jen Raff. This was another indication that he'd engineered an invitation to Cynthia's gathering just to meet the detective. What a shame, Matthew thought, that Jen hadn't spent more time with the man and listened to his concerns. But he knew Jen would already be thinking the same, would be haunted by guilt, and he didn't intend to make her feel worse. On the same page, hardly legible and scribbled at the last minute, it seemed, in different ink, Yo had written a number, 8531, or 8537, Matthew wasn't quite sure. Some sort of reference or pin? He put the diary in his briefcase and moved into the bedroom, overlooking the garden, which Yo must have once shared with his wife. The room wasn't at all what Matthew had been expecting. It had none of the bachelor austerity of the downstairs rooms and was quite different in tone. There was a faint smell of fresh paint, and one wall was vivid red. A huge black-and-white photograph of a lighthouse with cliffs beyond hung there. The style seemed more Eve's than Nigel's, and Matthew wondered if this had been the daughter's attempt to cheer him up, to move him on from the period of grieving. He then went into the attached bathroom. There were candles on a shelf near the bath, and on hooks on the door, two dressing gowns, two electric toothbrushes over the sink. Perhaps Nigel Yeo hadn't been the grieving widower everyone had thought him to be. Matthew looked at his watch. It was still only 10:30. He checked the number Ross May had provided for Lauren Miller and punched it into his phone. A woman answered, and when he introduced himself, she said, "Of course. You want to talk about Nigel? I saw the news yesterday afternoon." The voice was ageless, pleasant, educated. "I live in Appledore." She gave him the address and the postcode. "I'll be waiting for you." When Ven was a boy, Appledore had been known as a rough place, a centre for drug dealing and teenage violence. It had the shipyard, as close to an industrial enterprise as anything in this part of the county. His mother had discouraged any social contact with the boys who lived in the town. Now the shipyard had closed and Appledore, at the mouth of the Torridge, North Devon's second river, had transformed itself into an arty place of immaculately painted cottages along the narrow streets, artisan coffee shops and expensive restaurants. Former council houses on the edge of the town were now mostly in private ownership. There was an annual book festival and galleries exhibited local artists. Few locals could afford to buy properties here, and in the winter many of the houses, second homes and holiday lets, were empty. Matthew supposed it was an improvement, but on a sunny Sunday morning he knew it would be a nightmare to find somewhere to leave his car, and he felt some nostalgia for the past. In the end, parking was no problem because Lauren lived a little out of the town, in a settlement of smart new houses. If she could afford to live here, with the landscaped gardens and the view over the Torridge to the estuary beyond, she hadn't started working at NDPT for the money. The house was minimalist, almost bare. Matthew couldn't imagine children here. There was one enormous seascape on a white wall. Matthew found his gaze pulled to it. The wild sky and the space made him feel dizzy, vertiginous. "Brilliant, isn't it?" Lauren was standing behind him. She was almost as tall as he was, elegant, silver-haired. Not elderly, but not feeling the need to dye her hair to prove that she was still stylish. Perhaps because of the name, he'd been expecting somebody younger, and there'd been a moment of awkwardness when she'd opened the door to him. He hadn't been quite sure that he'd found the right place. "I got it from a student's degree show when I was living in London, but the artist is Cornish. I think you can tell." "But when did you move here?"
"Just over a year ago. I grew up in Bidford and was here until I went to university."
She turned, gestured for him to take a seat on one of the sofas.
"I came back because of my mother. She's almost blind now. We live together. It's not that she can't manage on her own, but after my father died, she became more isolated. She'd always been such a lively, companionable soul, and I couldn't bear the thought of her being lonely. We sold her cottage in the town and moved in together."
There was a pause. "But of course I had selfish reasons for running home too. A messy divorce. We'd never had children, and my share of the flat in Highgate easily bought me this place and gave me enough to live on until retirement."
"And yet you decided to go back to work."
"Ah, that was to keep me sane." Lauren smiled. "And because Nigel asked me to."
"You were friends."
She didn't respond at first.
"Rather more than friends, I hope, in the last few months at least."
"You were lovers." Although he'd already suspected that there was more to the relationship, Matthew felt himself blushing. The Puritan upbringing could come back to shock him when he was least expecting it.
"Only recently. We had been close friends for a while. Why are you so surprised, Inspector? Is it our age that makes it so unlikely?"
"Eve didn't mention a relationship," Matthew said. "I thought she would have done."
"Eve didn't know. I've met her, but only a couple of times, and then with other people. Nigel and I were very discreet and had decided to wait to go public. It would have been very tricky because of working together, and Eve was so close to her mother. Besides," she gave another sad smile, "there was something exciting about the secrecy. It made us feel young and foolish, romantic. We wanted the chance to be selfish for a while. I hadn't even told my mother."
She looked directly at Matthew, and he could tell how wretched she was.
"How did you meet Nigel?"
"It was at a dinner party at Frank Lay's place, Westercombe. I'd worked with Frank briefly in London, and I liked him. Perhaps we had things in common coming from the same part of the country, not quite fitting in with the brash young money men. I sent him an email when I moved back down, and he invited me along. We all sat around the table in his grand dining room, Frank, Eve, Nigel, and another guy who worked there.
Wesley Curnow."
"Yes, that's right. I was sitting next to Nigel."
She paused.
"I remember everything about that night. It was a first step in moving on from my previous life. Nigel said that the woman at his work who looked after the accounts had taken early retirement. I volunteered to take over until they could employ someone."
"And you're still there?"
"Yes, it keeps my brain active. The accountancy's basic, but it's a good cause, and the financial situation was pretty chaotic before I took it on."
She smiled.
"The pay's hardly more than the living wage, but that's not why I'm there."
There was a moment of silence before Matthew spoke.
"You seem very composed."
"On the outside, perhaps. I've been trying to hold things together in front of my mother. It's hard, grieving on my own. In one sense, I don't believe I have a right to grieve, certainly not publicly. To the rest of the world, we had nothing special, and I'd hate to appropriate feelings that seem out of place and which might offend his daughter. I'd be grateful if you'd respect my confidence about our relationship."
A beat. What is going on here, Inspector? I can think of no reason why anyone would want Nigel dead.
I'm hoping that you might be able to help with that, Matthew said. You worked with Nigel and you were very close. Do you know what took him to Westercombe the night he died?
She shook her head. I knew about the party. He had invited himself to a gathering at Cynthia Pryor's house, hoping to meet one of your officers.
Why did he need to speak to her?
Lauren shook her head. I don't know. It was a last-minute thing, and we didn't have a chance to discuss it. We'd talked about my staying at his house that night, but he sent me a text to cancel. It was very apologetic. It said he was hoping to get informal professional advice about something he was working on.
The Mackenzie suicide.
I assumed so.
Was he working on anything else that might have needed input from a police officer?
Oh, I don't think so. Much of the stuff he worked on was pretty routine.
She looked up.
He asked if I'd like to go to the party with him, but I couldn't quite face it. I wanted even my mother to know before we went out in public as a couple.
She got to her feet and moved towards the window.
If I'd been there, he would probably still be alive.
She was still standing there when an elderly woman came in through a door at the far end of the room. She walked with a cane, but her back was straight and her white hair was as beautifully cut as her daughter's.
I was thinking it was time for a pre-lunch sherry, darling, and I wondered if you'd like one.
We've got a visitor, Lauren said. Inspector Venn. He's investigating Nigel Yeo's murder.
Good afternoon.
Matthew got to his feet. It seemed a politeness, even if the woman couldn't see him. She turned in his direction.
I don't suppose you'd join us for a sherry, Inspector?
I'm sorry, he said. I'm afraid it's a busy time, and of course I'm working.
Of course.
She hesitated for a moment, as if choosing her words carefully.
I never met Dr. Yeo, but my daughter's a fine judge of character, and she says he was a good man. I have a sense that she's missing him more than she wants to acknowledge to me.
There was another hesitation. She moved towards Lauren and reached out with the hand that wasn't using the cane to touch her daughter's arm, a gesture of tenderness.
My sight is very poor, but there's nothing wrong with my hearing. A mother hates to hear her daughter weeping in the middle of the night. She's been so happy in the past couple of months, and I was delighted for her. Now there's this. Please find Nigel's killer. I know that won't bring him back, but it'll give us a story. Something to help Lauren understand this terrible nightmare.
Of course, Matthew said. We'll do all we can. He wanted to promise a result, to provide some reassurance. But in the end, he thought there was nothing more he could say. When he let himself out, the two women were still standing by the window at the far end of the room, their arms around each other.
Chapter 14. When Jen left the Pryor house, she was tense, restless. The encounter with Cynthia had upset her, and she found herself brooding about it as she walked into the town centre. It was still not quite 11 o'clock. The River Tor was low, the tide was out, and it smelled of mud and rotting vegetation. In the police station, Vicky Robb, a uniformed PC attached to the team, was poring over CCTV, but Ross and Matthew weren't there.
Vicky looked up. I'm trying to find a recording of Dr. Yeo's car leaving the town on Friday night. There's a camera in Bickington and you'd think he'd have gone that way.
Nothing yet?
No, I'm stopping to grab a coffee. The quality's really poor and I'm going boggle-eyed.
At her computer, Jen looked up everything she could find on Roger Pryor. No criminal record, but she'd been expecting that. Some press coverage, though, and some brief mentions on social media which she found interesting, and which she decided to follow up on. It seemed the Pryors had moved to North Devon not long before Jen. They'd been living in London before that, and Roger had been director of mental health services of a large health trust in Camden. The move to a much smaller trust, even when he was taking on the new role as CEO of Combined Services, seemed hard to explain. Had Roger, so controlled and private, suffered from some stress-related crisis or burnout? Perhaps it was simpler than that.
Perhaps Cynthia had had a romantic notion for a life away from the city and had persuaded him to move. She was a woman who liked to get her own way. Jen pulled up past copies of a local North London newspaper from the time 9 months before the Pryors' move from the capital. Soon she was finding it as hard to keep focused as Vicky, who'd returned from her coffee break to stare at the CCTV footage. But Jen persisted. In the end, the piece was easy to find. A front-page article with a photo, Roger looking dignified, standing outside a hospital at a press conference. The article reported the finding of a serious case review into the death of a young man. The headline read, "Review finds no individual to blame." Jen read on. A 16-year-old lad had hanged himself in his hospital room. Staff, only meters away, had been chatting by the nurse's station. The young man, whose name was Luke Wallace, had been suffering multiple mental health problems and had been brought into the hospital by the police. They had been called out by the family after the boy had become violent at home, smashing furniture and threatening a younger sister. The family had earlier asked for community health support, but nobody had turned up to help. The same newspaper, 6 months later, reported Pryor's resignation. Despite having been cleared by the serious case review, it seemed his position had become untenable. While the facts surrounding Luke Wallace's death were substantially different from the Alexander Mackenzie case, Jen could see why Roger had become jittery and had wanted to close down Nigel Yeo's investigation. The last thing he'd want would be another big press story about the death of a vulnerable young man. Once Jen had tracked down the original story, it had been easy to find the social media gossip and chat around the case. There was a Love Luke Facebook group sharing memories of the boy. It seemed he'd been warm, friendly, until he'd hit early adolescence, when he'd become withdrawn and moody. The impression given was that his family was close. His father worked in a library and his mother was a social worker. His younger brother was bright and popular. The mother had posted a plea to other parents. We'd thought he was a classic moody teen and that he'd grow out of it. We were complacent. We thought bad things didn't happen to people like us. He was ill and we were too busy with our own lives to notice. We allowed him to spend too much time on his own in his room, too much time online. Don't be like us. Be aware of your children and what they're doing. She had taken all responsibility for her son's death, all the guilt. But Twitter had found a different target. The hashtag #LoveLuke accompanied tweets blaming the Trust and Roger Pryor in particular. Don't let this man wreck more young lives. Jen could understand why he'd resigned and made the move to Barnstable. Jen sat back in her chair and considered the implications. Her first thought was personal. She'd considered Cynthia her best friend, yet the woman had never discussed the background to the Pryor's move from London. It seemed that Pryor had been horribly harassed by social media, even though he'd been cleared of all blame by the official review. Jen felt real sympathy for the couple. No wonder Cynthia had been so prickly and tense. But this must be relevant to their investigation, and she had to work out the best way to move forward. Jen didn't want to talk to Luke's mother without checking with Ven first, and Ven had said he shouldn't be disturbed unless it was urgent. She was too close to the Pryors to challenge them about this now. That would be down to somebody else. Jen's thoughts returned to Cynthia, so loud and proud with her size and her coloured clothes, and considered what an effort it must have taken her friend to put on such a show each day, because the move from London to Barnstable felt close to disgrace. Perhaps over the years it had become easier. Perhaps the couple were beginning to forget the reason for their move to the southwest. Then Alexander Mackenzie had killed himself, and it would have seemed that the past had come back to haunt them. They'd escaped the Luke Wallace story by moving, but surely it wouldn't have remained hidden if Nigel Yeo had had his way. There was a real temptation to go back to Cynthia's grand house, not as a police officer but as a friend, to say she understood, to share a bottle of wine and let Cynthia pour out her worries. But she was a cop, so in the end she stayed where she was, and she pulled together all the facts she'd gleaned into a report to pass on to Matthew Venn when he returned to the office. She was still staring at the computer screen, checking what she'd written, when she heard Vicky Robb give a whoop from her end of the room. It was a relief to get up, to stretch her back and her legs and to walk to where Vicky was sitting.
"What have you got?"
Jen kept her voice as upbeat as she could.
"His car, at last. Not from the street camera in Bickington, but from the petrol station just outside Instow. It's a late night one, closes at midnight. He was there at 11:30.
Vicky was jubilant. She'd almost given up on finding anything.
"Wouldn't he have turned off for Westerham before hitting Instow?
Maybe he was just low on fuel and wanted to stock up before heading out into the wilderness."
"Yeah, that was probably it. At least it gives us some sort of time frame."
But Jen made a note in her briefing report. It was just another detail to pass on to Matthew Venn. She was thinking she might go home, check up on the kids. She thought of Ben, a moody teenager who spent too long in his room in front of a computer screen. Ross May came in then, and he wanted to tell her about his talk with Janie McKenzie. That was classic Ross, impatient, wanting to spill out everything he knew, like a kid coming home after the end of a school day, full of what had happened in class, forcing his parents to hear every detail. She sat down again and thought she'd give him 10 minutes. No longer. That was when the phone rang.